Well, good morning. This is Per Fagren, KBOO News and Public Affairs, and our guest is Kevin Phillips, author of Bad Money. This is has come out in a paperback edition, and it's got a new preface and a new afterword, and that's a lot of new writing because it's they total about 90 more pages in this book. The book came out last year. And while we're talking about the economy, let our listeners know that tomorrow Portland will be part of the National Day of Protest. There will be a rally tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square. So that is happening tomorrow. So now on to Kevin. Kevin Phillips, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Well, I just heard that yesterday Larry Summers said something about the era of free fall is ending. And then later on, I was listening to BBC News, and they were saying that global trade is in free fall.
Well, I think he's probably talking about the free fall in the stock market.
Uh-huh.
And for the time being, that may be true. I think that the market got to a point at its low in early March that basically a lot of stocks, not by any means all, but a fair minority were being valued at virtual doomsday levels. So I may not disagree with Summers there. However, I think in terms of we can count on unemployment to keep going down, we can count on mortgage foreclosures will continue to be high and probably mounting. There are a lot of negatives. Now, the problem, one of the problems that the Obama administration has, and it's a big surprise to me, but they are in the same sort of judging themselves by how well they serve Wall Street role that the Bush administration did under Hank Paulson. And I think you have with Summers somebody whose first gauge there is whether the free fall can be ended on Wall Street. And I think maybe it is ended. We could have another degree of the crisis of banks. I think when credit cards start showing a really high rate of non-payment, much more than is talked about now, and they're in the early stages of it. But for the moment, I think free fall in the stock market is not going to be the headline.
Okay. Now, in your preface, the revised preface this book, you said that the credit crisis, that the government exaggerated that in order to get a bailout. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's really a pretty striking phenomenon when you think about it. I wish people would start going back and trying to reconstruct the events, let's say, of September 7th or 8th to September 20th. Alan Greenspan recently commented, and he says one thing one week and changes it a bit a month later, but he said the economy fell off a cliff on September 15th. Now, I don't think that's true. What happened was you had a crisis among the major banking and investment firms. And that's a big problem, but that's not the overall economy falling off a cliff. What happened was that essentially the Bush administration and a number of people in Congress on the Democratic side as well as the Republican side started to voice the whole line that the economy could be gone by Monday if we don't have a bailout bill.
Oh, I remember that, yes.
All that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they created, I think, a panic psychology in the minds of a lot of Americans and a lot of other people that then made a lot of other yardsticks besides the stock market start heading south. But I think that the principal concern of the policymakers back in September is also the principal concern of the policymakers now, and that's the financial sector. I think that's where the principal concern, and beyond that, probably even the principal loyalties are.
Well, now, in your book, a big, probably the main point is that financial efforts are kind of looming large. I mean, the financial operations have replaced manufacturing. We're not making things anymore. We're kind of pushing money around.
Well, that's a very unfortunately accurate summarization of what happened. Not that the politicians or even the major media will talk about it, but in a nutshell, if you go back to what they call the gross national product data, about 1979 or 80, you would see that manufacturing was 25% and the finance, insurance, real estate sector was about 10 to 12%. If you look in 2004 at the peak of the real estate mortgage financing boom, you get the finance, insurance, real estate sector, by that point being called financial services, even by the Wall Street crowd, was up to just under 21% of GDP, and manufacturing had gone down to 12%. Now, manufacturing was what created a broad-based prosperity in the United States in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. Finance creates a wonderama for a small group of people at the top, while everything is going along and they're inventing every type of little whiz-bang and then selling it everywhere you can imagine to banks here and banks overseas. And it looks like we're in a new world. Unfortunately, you know, finance turned out part of its last metastasis was to turn into cancer. And now we've got the cancer patient, and the administration won't operate any more than the Bush administration will operate. The importance of the financial sector in terms of the gross domestic product is, I think, at this point probably shrinking noticeably. What is not shrinking is the commitment of the government in Washington basically to keeping finance as the mainstay of the U.S. economy. I think that is a disastrous mistake.
Well, you know, they talk about wealth creation when they do this, and I don't understand exactly what they mean.
Well, wealth creation, if you're somebody who's had a $3 or $4 million house in the Hamptons and Long Island or lots of other places, probably even a couple of neighborhoods of Portland, wealth creation has been fabulous for people in the financial sector. As the financial sector has prospered, the less fashionable and increasingly sort of unfashionable manufacturing sector has lost jobs. Those were much better paid jobs for the ordinary American. And at the same time, the ordinary American has seen the finance turning into a Frankenstein and, to mix metaphors, falling off, you know, Jack's overgrown beanstalk. For the average family, you've seen problems with pensions, problems with money saved for kids' school, problems with parents who don't have money and now have to be helped, endless numbers of things. You're going to see taxes at the state level going up almost everywhere. Mm-hmm. One of the papers just ran a list of states where probably both income and sales tax would go up. My own state of Connecticut is one of them. I don't know, maybe Oregon is too.
Well, we don't have sales tax here. We don't have sales tax in Oregon.
Well, they'll find something else to raise.
We have income tax, which is basically it's a flat tax because the top bracket is 9%, and almost everyone is in this. And then they have, local property taxes. But Oregon has voted down a sales tax, I think, about 9 times.
Well, if you've got a 9% flat tax, then given the way the dynamics of these things go, it'll take the biggest bite of disposable income out of people in the middle and low middle.
That's probably true, right?
Yeah.
This shift to the financial sector, is there any sense in which that is built into the system? I mean, a lot of people think, well, it's just a bunch of guys on the top got greedy and no one was around to stop them. But is there some way that this is just kind of part of the system? Because you talk about, other economic powers where the same thing happened.
Well, first of all, yes, if you go back and look at the previous leading economic powers in the world, most recently Britain before us, but before that Holland when New York was New Amsterdam, and before that Habsburg Spain when basically that was half of Europe, you find that they all tended to lose their global preeminence out of a combination of financialization and too much debt and too many overreaching foreign policy and military objectives. And that describes the previous three. I think, unfortunately, it really describes us too. Real reason to be concerned. And the other thing that happens is that the financial elites in sort of the later years of the hegemony of the leading world economic power, the financial elites get entrenched. They're very hard to pry loose, even when they start to fail and the country's fading. And I think that reflects itself right now in the power they have in terms of political donations. I mean, they're clearly number one, and then nobody's close in terms of money donated to federal office seekers, the president and Congress. And it's both parties, and at this point in time, I think their hold on the Democratic Party is more critical to them, and that's probably where the attention is going. But basically, one of the reasons I think we'll have an awful lot of trouble reforming finance is that finance has so much political influence.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually happening in four economic powers. That seems to be some kind of a real pattern, suggests that there's something just about the capitalist system that makes this happen. It's not just, you can say, well, in some ways it's a lot easier to be an investor rather than actually make something, because then you have to worry about all sorts of, mechanical, machinery.
Or getting old and not being able to work.
if you're the owner of a factory, yeah. A lot of things you have to worry about, where if you just invest in something, you just kind of sit back and clip your coupons and rake in your money. But is there any...
Yeah, that's certainly been a pattern in the ones that I cited. However, if you go back before the supposed rise of capitalism,
mm-hmm.
and that would be associated with the... late 15th and 16th century and the Renaissance and so forth, you probably still find societies where elites stopped working and just sort of lived off their power or their control over people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's something that's absolutely limited to the capitalist system or specific, but probably in its present form, it's related to it. But my recollection is that the Soviet Union was very successful in developing a whole bunch of elites, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it happened with the Roman Empire, too. I mean, the senatorial class kind of stopped any reforms from happening. But, I guess in some sense, it's like, this is like a cancer on the economy. It's almost like death in disguise. This is the way economies die.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I've been writing about the previous great economic powers and the financialization problem for about two decades at this point. And while I find the arguments are always changing and getting more intensive in their analysis of how the United States is falling into the pattern, it doesn't seem to elicit much doubt from people about how it did work before. And I think that it's a very difficult thing to cope with. I doubt that we'll be able to do it. For one thing, the media and the opinion molders and political office holders obviously, and for very good reasons, don't like to discuss it. They don't want to admit that finance has gotten into this role and that they, the politicians and regulators, let it happen or were too minimally paying attention to stop it from happening.
You also mentioned in your preface that the U.S. drove down the price of oil. How did that happen?
Well, you're talking about in 2008, probably.
Yeah, it hit, almost got to $150 a barrel.
Yeah.
Then it went way down.
The way I would explain you got a government involvement, and it's, I wouldn't say that they just by edict drove it down. However, here is a hypothesis which covers a somewhat indirect way that happened. A lot of the speculators in the big financial firms were very much front and center in speculating on commodity prices and driving up the price of oil, for 2 years before it peaked. Now, the government, especially Treasury and the White House in the summer of 2008, were getting very concerned about oil prices, but also about the role of speculators in pushing them up. And if you go back at that point in time, they started talking about prosecuting speculators and singling out people who were doing this, and Congress did too. Now, that didn't really happen too much, but it did happen, and you can watch for 3, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks. There was some press discussion of firms that were being singled out. But what it really convinced the financial people to do was to turn around and stop speculating in commodities, but to start shorting commodities. And by that I mean they were betting on a price decline, so they made money out of a price decline, so they started to come down quite quickly because the financial firms, I think they more or less got the idea that, yes, the government would like to bail them out, but the government would be a lot happier if they were pushing down the price of commodities as opposed to pushing them up. And you did stop seeing all the reference to speculators running up the price because they were preferred when they were running down the price. The difficulty is that the price is at this point too low to encourage development, so in all likelihood, when demand starts to rise again, you'll see another surge, and of course the financial sector will do anything to make money, bet on it or bet against it.
Well, I think it went down as far as low as $30 a barrel, maybe even less than that briefly, and I think now it's up to in the 50s or something.
That's correct, yeah.
And I think the long-range oil contracts are being sold for a lot more than that.
Yes, and the prognoses of anybody looking at the energy industry are such that they see, well, maybe demand this year will be down by 2% globally. Some say more, but I think most people assume that's probably true. But they'll see that by later in this year, it's starting to rise again, even though it may be in negative territory because of the numbers for the first half of the year. And then beyond that, we'll probably see oil rise to 70, 80, or 90 pretty quickly, because that's the level at which, if you don't have a price at that level, it's not going to be economic. And I'm not playing games here. I genuinely think it would not be economic for a lot of this to be expensive energy projects to be developed. You won't see a lot of the environmentally friendly stuff again until you see oil back in the $80 or $90 a barrel range to make the additional cost of the environment-free energy efforts workable.
Well, this is Per Fogring, and we're talking with Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money. And if people have a question, the number to call is 503-231-8187. So in the revised preface, too, you talk about the price revolution, the first price revolution, and now a second one perhaps coming. Can you go into that a little bit?
I can. Let me take about, well, I'll probably need 90 seconds to lay it out a little bit. The notion of a price revolution originated as people began in later centuries to study what happened to Europe in the middle and late 16th and early 17th centuries, when prices rose very significantly, 300 or 400% over a period, depending how you calculate it, of 50 to 80 years. Now, what was generally said to be responsible for that was the flow of gold and silver from the New World into Spain, and that pushed prices up. But as economists and economic historians got more into this, they came to the conclusion that what was really operating was a much larger pattern that involved the rapid growth of Europe, partly because of ties to the New World, but also because of speeded up industrialization on a sort of low level, but nevertheless, a much increased trade, a whole lot more control from Europe of the rest of the world, not just the Americas under Spain and Portugal, but increasingly European control of the maritime routes and trade in Africa and Asia. So the upshot of the analysis was that this transfer of power from the West and wealth from the rest of the world to Europe was involved in creating a price revolution. Now, my theory, which is set out in the book, is essentially that much the same thing is happening now as power shifts to Asia. If you look at, here I'm doing my second little analysis, so mm-hmm. give me about the same time on that one. As we've seen power start shifting to Asia in the sense that the United States has been fighting Asian wars for the last 50-odd years in Korea and Vietnam and the Middle East. We've been having problems with prices, inflation coming off these wars. We see commodity prices, and again, they tend to be most important to Asia because that's who produces most of the commodities. Those prices are increasing rapidly, so my thesis is that we are in the middle of another price revolution that started, oh, say, in the late 60s because of Vietnam and inflation, and then the rise in oil prices in the 70s, and then we had a remission from this in the late 80s and 90s, and then prices started rising again in the 2000s. They're taking a hiatus, a vacation, so to speak, since the middle of 2008, probably through about now, and I think commodity prices are getting ready to rise again, and I think they probably will globally for another 15, 20, 25 years.
Well, this power shift to Asia, you know, the American foreign policy establishment has always been concerned with this, whoever controls the heartland, namely Asia and Russia, you know, that whole part of the world kind of controls the world, that is where the resources are located and the population and everything. And according to this theory, that the U.S. strategy has always been to try and get in there, get in and be part of the this heartland. And right now, it looks like they're pretty well shutting us out. So we're fighting geography in a way.
We're fighting geography, but the United States, during its period of rise to global economic leadership, was not a heartland strategy power. The British were, and a lot of the British policy in the early 20th century was still dedicated towards increasing their control of the Middle East and countering Russia in the Caucasus and in parts of Central Asia. But that wasn't our menu. The United States was already the leading world economic power by the time it started paying attention to these things. And you could probably say attention was paid in the 30s and 40s. At this point in time, and people are talking again about the so-called great game which the British and Russians played and that we're playing it, but we're probably going to be squeezed out. I don't have any faith in the ability of the United States to maintain its sort of toeholds on the fringe. And I would say that includes very conspicuously the Persian Gulf. You probably have to put Israel on the list. I think Turkey will move further away from the United States. I think that Afghanistan and Pakistan are very unstable, and that we will not be able to maintain our power there for very long. So I would assume that the rise of Asia will be at the expense of the United States geopolitically and also economically.
Mm-hmm. I think we have a caller on the line, so let's see what the caller has to say. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Bear. Thank you. Mr. Phillips, what an honor indeed. I've been a long admirer of your work. I especially enjoyed your American Theocracy attention to that subject. And earlier you did mention something about campaigns here in the United States. Now, it may have that implication, that chain link, chain reaction globally and change things that way too, but is there hope for, and is it not pivotal that we in this country have some substantive campaign finance reform? Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Oh, yes, I agree with that, but the big difficulty is that Congress will never pass anything that isn't either vague enough to be tossed out in the courts or has loopholes or whatever. It's hard for me to see how they can crack down across the board as long as they're in the dependence pattern that they're in. I think if state after state were to turn basically to public financing of elections, at a certain point, and I don't think there are more than three or four or so that do now, at a certain point you would probably really put the pressure on. I don't see Obama doing this because in the end he got so much money in contributions. Why should he turn off the spigot that flows
right.
best for him?
So each state, in so many ways, does represent the what we used to call the laboratory or the laboratory for change in the country. The West Coast leads in so many ways, including the medicalization of marijuana. And so you think it might be possible that we can do it state by state and change this not only decrepit but corrupt system?
Well, I think it's certainly a good idea to try. I would say that even though I don't believe that Obama will crack down on finance in Washington or put too much prestige on the line for campaign reforms that he doesn't believe will pass, he might be persuaded to endorse the state-by-state public finance, since that doesn't particularly imperil him. But as long as he has access to this huge amount of money, I would be very dubious that he would find this a repulsive system.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Pear.
Do you think that, does that mean then that we just sort of have to wait until the whole thing collapses before anything is done?
Well, I don't know what it means exactly. Mm-hmm. Do I see the possibility of a collapse? Yes. Do I mm-hmm. see the likelihood? No. I think what we will probably be looking at is that the United States, if you start the process in 2000, when the first bubble popped right at the end of the Clinton administration, the tech bubble, and at that point the Dow Jones Industrial Average was at 11,700. Right now it's just about at 8,000. My guess would be that maybe by 2011, 2012, we'll have a Dow that's somewhere at 9,000 or thereabouts, but inflation will start picking up, and the overall inflation adjustment will be 40-45% for the period. So in inflation-adjusted terms, you would see that the Dow for those 12 years or 13 years would have been down by something like 60-65%. I think people in the middle socioeconomic group will find that their purchasing power continues to fall. Obviously, raises aren't going to be particularly good. Lost housing values are going to be a huge problem. Maintaining disposable income for everything from medical expenses to putting kids through school is going to be very, very difficult. So I would say the next 2 years are not going to be great years. On the other hand, you probably, and I hope, won't have any need to compare them to a 1933. It wouldn't be like that.
Well, one thing inflation does, it makes it a little easier to pay off debts.
Yes, and I think the government is mindful enough of that the government would like to have it easier to pay off debts, too, and that inflation is the best bet. Now, the difficulty we have here is that when inflation got really high back in 1979 and 80, the Federal Reserve had to push the government set interest rates up into the 17-18% range, 19%. That was more or less the peak. Now, if they have anything like that inflation right now, that will send the U.S. dollar, which is already weak, right into the toilet. And the consequences of that would be very substantial, and we faced only a limited version of that back 30 years ago. This time, I think we'd face a very high-powered version of it. The United States is vulnerable to the extent that foreigners start to understand the huge difficulties that have developed here.
Well, this brings us back to China. You know, they've been making noises about not being happy with the value of the dollar, and you know, maybe possibly shifting their dollar holdings into other areas. But then you have people saying, I think Paul Krugman was one of them, saying that well, that China can't afford to dump the dollar, that they would, lose all their holdings. And I don't know, do you agree with that? Or it seems to me that at some point they might decide that there's no other recourse.
Well, let's take the situation in China. It usually doesn't get profiled, so let me profile it very quickly. They've got about $700 billion in treasury, bills, notes, and bonds, and obviously those are all dollar holdings. If they were to dump them or get tough with the United States, they would lose a significant chunk there, whether it would be 15, 20, 30% of that $700 billion, I don't know. On the other hand, they are not going to be exporting nearly as much to the United States in the next couple of years as they had been. That means that they're not going to be pulling together an increasing kitty of dollars the way they did. So they're not going to be buying very many more, even if they don't sell what they have. Simply the loss of that demand will be difficult for the United States, because I don't see the purchases coming from a lot of other places. Now, the Chinese do have another option. They have recently become the world's number one gold producer, pulling ahead of South Africa and Canada, and the United States is a little further down. I think that the Chinese government's signals should be heeded that China would like to buy a lot more gold, and if they were to buy a significant amount, say $100 billion worth of gold a year, I would say in 2 or 3 years the price of gold could go up by 250 or 300%, in other words, double or quadruple.
Mm.
And in that case, that would be negative for the dollar, but the Chinese, if they have a large stock of gold and produce the largest amount of gold, would stand to benefit enormously from the doubling or trebling of the value of gold, and it would make up for what they lost on their dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly what Paul wrote. I mean, he's a very knowledgeable guy, but that guillotine of gold is out there. More and more Asian countries are taking an interest in it. The Russians are talking about trying to increase their gold holdings, too.
Mm. Well, I guess if I had money, I'd do the same. I'd buy an ounce or two, but my money's kind of tied up in food and rent. So, what else can China do with all these dollar holdings? Can they use it to buy up oil contracts around the world, or can they spend it in other ways?
Well, they can certainly do a lot of different things. We've seen some indications of what they want to do. The Chinese are stockpiling certain strategic minerals. They've stockpiled some oil, I don't know how much, some of the others as well, buying them while they're cheap. Now, the Chinese, clearly the sentiment in the commodity markets in the last couple of weeks has been to see China coming back in on commodities like copper. Now, how much of this is stockpiling, I don't know, but probably a considerable amount. The Chinese are in a position, they have all this money, that they can put some of it into commodities. If I were a Chinese strategist, I'd rather put my money into gold or oil at the current price than U.S. Treasury notes at the current price.
Well, they could also do things to repair their own environment. I mean, I think that China is very vulnerable to food shortages, and they're really, from what I understand, they are really doing terrible things to their farmland.
Well, they're, in addition to doing terrible things to it environmentally, which in places they are, they're putting a huge emphasis on it. All of the Asian countries, and this is one of the things that's going to support the second price revolution, they're forced into major, major expenditures for new roads, for new water supplies, for all kinds of things having to do with agriculture, like pesticides and, for that matter, even easy credit, because they need to produce so much more food in order to feed a rapidly rising Asian lower middle and middle class. And there's no alternative to that. They can't afford to get the food from the West because the prices there are rising, too, if you look at prices in supermarkets. So I think that, yes, they'll try to increase their agricultural capacity, and they'll try, to a certain extent, to deal with environmental problems. But if I were a Chinese strategist, I guess I would say to the people in the United States and Germany and Britain and so forth, you don't want us to do what you did during the 19th century when you built everything without worrying about the environment. We can't afford to do everything. It's your turn to do all the environmental things that you didn't do back then. Of course, the problem is we can't afford it now either.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose China, you know, they apparently a lot of their labor force is migrating back to the countryside. They've lost their jobs in the cities. They're going back to the countryside. I'm not sure what they have to do there, but it would seem that they could be. Is it possible to have them resettle on the land and do something with that?
I'm not knowledgeable enough to say. The numbers that you hear are something like 10 million people. Now, mm-hmm. for China, that's peanuts,
because mm-hmm.
you're looking at a population of, 1.5 trillion there. So that's not a huge thing. Probably they're going back to live with extended families, a number of which would be in the country. Some of that happened in the United States in the 30s, too. But in that particular case, in the United States in the 30s, the back-to-the-farm thing was significant, like 3 or 4%. I don't think there's any sign of anything like that number in China yet.
We are talking with Kevin Phillips, who's the author of Bad Money, which first came out last year, but now is a new updated paperback edition. It has a new preface and an afterwards, which total about 90 new pages. A very interesting reading. Tell me, what do you think of the G20 conference? Do they make any progress or do anything worth doing?
Oh, I think from the standpoint of all the countries that are in the G20 that weren't in the G7, that they made a whole lot of progress because they're getting their viewpoints on the table a lot more successfully. They're clearly getting rid of a G7-dominated discussion forum in favor of one that includes much more significantly Asia and Latin America. Now, did they get a whole lot done? No, I don't think so, except for the fact that they basically serve notice that this is going to be the new vehicle. You know, no more global economy run for 6 or 7 countries. And in that sense, I think it's very important for them. It's going to be a problem for the United States and Britain and so forth. However, one of the few things that they did get done was they agreed kind of loosely on increased regulation of financial abuses. Now, I believe that that's serious and lacking in loopholes when I see it. But nevertheless, it represents something of a beginning. Now, the Europeans and a number of others felt that they had done enough to stimulate the economy, and they didn't want to do any more because they were afraid of inflation. The United States, I think, is uniquely vulnerable because in this country, it's a major systemic problem. It's the rise of this almost rogue financial sector, which is not that important anywhere else. And you've got the politicians and the administration people are desperate for more stimulus because they want somehow or other to get more money into the hands of the banks and the financial sector. And you're familiar with this PPIP program?
Not really.
Yeah, well, it's the new one.
Oh.
I like to think of it as pipsqueak. It's one way
okay.
But it's the program that the administration has set up with Geithner in the Treasury as the principal man there. And they will do public-private partnerships to loan financial groups the money to buy so-called toxic paper, of which there is an enormous amount because the people that came up with all this garbage came up with a lot of it.
One thing we're not running out of.
That's right. And one thing that the government really wants is to see, basically what they're doing is they're subsidizing with cheap loans people who they want to buy up this garbage to raise its price. Now, if it doesn't work, the cheap loans and the whole undertaking bounces back on the taxpayer. But that hasn't stopped anything so far in the bailout, so I doubt that it will now. But it's a something people should really watch, because what it tells you is that there is just a never-ending quest to get more money into the hands of the people who proved that their hands were totally unreliable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you talk about Frankenstein finance, and it sounds like with all the stimulus, this time Frankenstein is really dead, and he's not going to get off that table.
Well, it's a possibility. If you think of the fiscal stimulus and all the money that's being spent, now, I don't think it's not all being spent that quickly. I think of a lot of it will be wasted, like government spending typically is. But in addition to that, you have this enormous monetary stimulus coming from the money creation of the Federal Reserve and all the ways they're pumping up liquidity and trying to get money into the hands of the financial sector. They have put enormous additional assets or liabilities, depending on how you look at it, on their books. And the likelihood is that this will be met by printing money. They insist, no, they would never do that. But I'm old enough to have watched the government print money a couple of times before. Mm-hmm. And they do it. And I think they will again.
Well, it's a Fed. If people want to call in with a question, our phone number is 503-231-8187. We're talking with Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money. Well, this printing money, it's actually, isn't the Fed that kind of loans it to the U.S.?
Well,
there's always a little debt involved. You know, we don't just print up our own money. Well, Lincoln did that with the greenbacks way back when, but we don't do that. We sell bonds to the Federal Reserve, and then there's an interest rate there that we have to pay for our own money. Is that the way it works?
The Federal Reserve creates money
mm-hmm.
is, in essence, when not just whether they buy or sell, which is the usual way of doing it, but when they take liabilities on their books and then allow the money supply to ratchet up without inhibiting the growth. If you go back and you look at Alan Greenspan, liquidity was always rising rapidly, even though they said inflation wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the difficulty was, and I have to cross specialties here, but I did a big piece in Harper's last year, which was called The Numbers Racket. And the government's inflation numbers are about as reliable as, a rotten rubber band breaking.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot tell from the government's inflation numbers how much of the debt is being monetized by the operations of the Fed. Now, maybe the Federal Reserve numbers will tell specialists, but I'm dubious about that because they've got different levels of money supply. They've got M1, M2. They got rid of M3, which was the thing that was showing a lot of growth. So my guess is, and I'm not the one to explain it in great economist accuracy, but that they will wind up monetizing a lot of the debt, not sterilizing money creation through the processes of the Open Market Committee and so forth, and that it will be, in that respect, somewhat like what you saw in this country during the Vietnam War, which Johnson wouldn't raise taxes to pay for, so inflation gathered. And then in 1972, when Nixon had wage and price controls, and the pressure for inflation built up and then surged when wage and price controls came off, and then you had a really major surge in 1979-80, and Paul Volcker, at first, who was the Fed chairman, didn't really want to raise rates, and inflation did surge. And then on the second pass in late 1980, he started really raising rates and raised them well into 1981. I forget the exact chronology. But that time they did crunch inflation. But generally speaking, the government has lots of ways of benefiting from inflation, and they're generally not disposed towards fighting it so much in reality as with, in my opinion, phony statistics that understate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, would it help to have government banks, like North Dakota has their own state bank, and an interesting article by Ellen Brown about that and how North Dakota is doing pretty well, I guess, with all the, you know, economic problems. They, you know, they have a budget surplus, and she says that they, North Dakota, can kind of float its own loans. They don't have to pay interest to the banks to get anything done.
Well, the question in the United States of changing the approach to the banking system has been raised. You've had, Paulson talked about operating Fannie and Freddie, the federal mortgage operations, as kind of utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the bank commentators, including Ken Lewis at Bank of America, suggested that maybe it will be necessary to divorce investment banking in whatever form from commercial banking. And one of the other things that said is we really should make commercial banks into quasi-utilities, just regulate them so they can't speculate and let them do these things, presumably like North Dakota does, without the speculative stuff, which is what ruins the bank. Of course, without that, they can't pay themselves the big bonuses, so they wouldn't like that. But I think people are probably less and less disposed to worry about what the bankers like and what they don't like.
Well, I guess the way I hear it is that there's, I think, 97% of all the money in existence comes into existence through a loan. In other words, you borrow money from the bank, you know, the banker kind of takes this number out of thin air, puts it in your account, and then you can spend that money. And, of course, then the bank has more reserves to lend out to other people.
Well, you can also create money in theory by printing it. In other words, if they just decided to print, increase the supply of $10,000 bills by, say, 10,000%, you'd notice it.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between the amount of cash currency and the money supply reflects all the loans, and somebody could take all that and make a variable out of it. Obviously, another thing that creates the money is the velocity of money, and the velocity of money means the amount of times it changes hands. If the money's sitting there, both in the loans and the notes, and it doesn't have enough velocity, then the money supply suffers. Don't ask me to define that.
Well, I think you're another caller on the line. So let's, caller, you're on the air.
Hello, Pear.
Yes.
Yeah, a question about municipal revenue bonds, such as for utilities like provision of water, public water supplies, or here in Oregon we have public utilities either owned by cities, municipals, or people's utility districts. Because there's a stream of payments, the revenue bonds are paid back by people consuming water or electricity. It seems to me to be relatively safe in a tumultuous market. I'd like to hear your opinion. And also a point is that Warren Buffett bought Pacific Power from Scottish Power about 4 or 5 years ago, and at that time he stated in the financial press that he had avoided investing in utilities for, I believe, 30 years, but finally jumped in the game because he liked the steady stream of income. Thank you.
Well, in terms of the different types of municipal obligations and how reliable they are, yeah, I guess I would take a fairly benign view of what you're discussing, but, and this isn't my area of any particular knowledge, the rating firms are now busy downgrading borrowing authorities, municipal and so forth, all across the country because of the souring economic circumstances. And I imagine that there are parts of the country in which you would have to worry somewhat about the utility payments, especially if a lot of the customers are in industries that aren't doing well. I don't know enough to take this any further, but I would have those caveats.
Thank you very much.
In your afterword, you mention Islamic banking, where one of the Islamic bankers said, we don't create money out of thin air. And is that a way to deal with the economic meltdown now?
Well, they have a type of finance, and I forget the word for it, but where essentially they have to avoid usury and the interest.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have ways to flim-flam that are apparently okay, although they come up with an interesting substitute. And again, I couldn't describe it, but in a number of Western countries, and Britain seems to be among the most prominent, there's starting to be some of this Islamic banking. And it's gotten a bit of credibility from the fact that obviously these banks are not in trouble. They've got a limitation on their lending that has to do with simply not reaching too far. Now, I hesitate to take that as anything assured because the odds are pretty good that you're going to find some clever Islamic lawyers in Singapore or Beirut or wherever that will begin to allow them to stretch the Quran and what it permits a little bit. At least if human nature is the same over there, I bet it'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I can see that spreading. If you just wanted to preserve your capital and you're somebody in Britain or in Singapore, and especially if you've got any sort of Islamic connections, you might figure it was safer in one of these banks than in the Royal Bank of Scotland or whatever.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller on the line. So, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. Sorry if this was proposed before this question came up. I didn't tune in until just a few minutes ago. But at any rate, I don't know if you've heard any of the more radical ideas that are being floated, such as, for example, really nationalizing these banks, and rather than letting them use this money that's being shoveled to them to reinflate their speculative derivatives bubble, rather than doing that, just essentially putting them out of business and shredding all the derivatives, which who knows how much, what they're worth. Many speculate that they're worth virtually nothing, and that they're just a huge distraction, and making anyone who wants to use any of this money that's being shoveled to relieve this system, loan it to manufacturing production, and essentially give us a new deal rather than you know, the same old deal that's led to this mess. Have you heard any radical proposals like this, and what do you think of that?
Well, I haven't heard anything. Certainly, you know, nothing more than little gossip, even about a serious program to use the banks in some way to revitalize manufacturing. Manufacturing has done very poorly recently and hasn't profited from the relatively weaker dollar like a number of people thought it would. And how likely it would be to get manufacturing really back on its feet. Now, I could stand corrected on that if the dollar tanks in the next year or two, because that might give manufacturing something of a second lease on life, as it appeared to do for a little while back in 2007 and the beginning of 2008. But I'm very dubious that you can take the banks and have the government run them effectively, probably for much of anything. The big problem I have with the banks at this point is that most of them got into a lot of other things, and a lot of the other things have allowed them to speculate even more avidly, and they can leverage different things. And in general, probably it would be a good thing to break up a lot of these the holding companies, bank holding companies, but they can hold just about anything. There are a few limitations, but not very much. The reason why most of them are too big to fail is they were allowed to get too big to fail by the Federal Reserve and others, who just let them merge away like a kid going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And if we broke them up and put them back into their component sections, there wouldn't be nearly as many that would be too big to fail. If they failed, they wouldn't take everything with them. How exactly you could nationalize derivatives is an interesting question.
Well,
I don't know how at this point. You've got global difficulties the insurance and the premiums demanded on credit default swaps have fallen now with the administration's latest bailout. If anything goes wrong, then they'll soar again. But these are counterparty relationships, and the whole buildup of finance in the last 20 years has been very heavy on borrowing huge amounts of money to leverage, and part of the leverage involved securitization. Part of the leverage also involved being able to make mortgages that wouldn't pay you much of anything for 2 years so that you could give them to all kinds of people who didn't really deserve them and might not be able to handle them, but what the hell, you'd securitize them and sold them off. Any solution at this point is going to be full of problems, and the only thing that I can say I would support, but I have no responsibility, so I can speak and it doesn't matter, would be to try to turn a lot of the banks into something more resembling a public utility that didn't have all these exotic things and couldn't even do them the way utilities are regulated as to what they can do. And I think we could do the same for the banks. My great-grandfather was the auditor of something called the Reading Railroad in Pennsylvania in the late 1890s, and he got the job because the Reading Railroad, when it failed, had huge amounts of debt. It was one of the big railroads in the East, and slowly but surely they turned railroads into utilities. If they could take railroads, which were the great speculative, some of the great speculative baddies of the 80s and 90s, and turn them into utilities, there's no reason why they can't do it.
Well, I think we'll have to end it on that. No, we've been talking with Kevin Phillips, author of Bad Money. It's out in paperback with a new preface and afterward. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
And to our listeners, don't forget tomorrow, National Day of Protest, and we'll be doing it down here at Pioneer Courthouse Square at 2 p.m. tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.